Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deal in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is so mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Elizabeth Sando, who already joined us 10 times and shared her truly deep insight into traditional Japanese food culture. Elizabeth is a food writer and Japanese cooking instructor based in Tokyo, and she has lived in Japan for over 50 years. She runs a culinary art program called A Taste of Culture, which offers a great opportunity for non-Japanese people to explore Japanese culture through its food. And Elizabeth also is also author of 6 cookbooks, including the award-winning Washoku, recipes from Japanese kitchen, and Kibo, recipes and stories from the Japan's Tohoku, and Kansha, celebrating Japan's vegan and vegetarian traditions. And today's topic is kombucha. Kombucha means dried things. And these are essential items in the traditional Japanese pantry, but rarely receive the attention they truly deserve. So today we'll discuss what kombucha is, why they are so precious, how you can use them, which is totally foolproof, and Elizabeth's favorite kombucha recipes, and much, much more. But before you start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So if you haven't, please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write the review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Elizabeth Sando. Hello, Elizabeth. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be back again.
Yeah, so it's we had a hiatus of about 2 years due to COVID. how have you been for the last crazy time?
Busy doing all sorts of things, mainly online rather than in person. And little by little, Japan is looking to open up again to visitors coming, which is good news, I think. But it's been a long haul. It's been an opportunity, though, for a lot of people to get into the kitchen and start making food that they perhaps would have been too busy to bother with before. And I really appreciate the fact that you let me choose the topic this time as kombucha, which is one of my favorite set of items in a Japanese kitchen. They, as you pointed out, they rarely get the acclaim that they really deserve. Ancient, but also modern and invaluable, I think.
Right. And also, I mean, when I grew up in Japan, I didn't even think of them, but they are kind of quietly secret weapons. So I look forward to learning more about them today.
I think so. I think for people who have never looked at them or wander through an Asian grocery store and see them, they wonder why people would ever want to use them. They're not particularly attractive. They're dried, shriveled. Most of them come in a sealed package, so you don't even have a sense of the aroma. And sometimes the instructions that are on the back of it are not immediately understandable. It seems almost too simple. Most of them need to be soaked various lengths of time. Some of them, the soaking liquid can be also consumed, others they can't. And they make a whole bunch of wonderful foods.
Right. So let's start from the beginning, because I think the majority of our listeners have no idea what we're talking about.
Okay.
So first of all, what is kombucha by definition, and what is the history of kombucha?
By definition, it's a dried thing. It covers a wide range of products sourced from various different terrain, from land and from sea. Some of them are animal products, some of them are not. The history is sort of interesting. The first written record was in the Manyoshu, which is a collection of poetry, 760 AD, I believe is the date, and is often quoted as the first written record for a lot of things. But truth be told, they were probably consumed prehistory, the Jomon period, which goes back to 14,000 BC. It's the kind of thing that probably was a natural phenomenon. Items got dried, and with the drying, the flavor became intensified, and also spoilage was retarded. So in the days long before refrigeration, or any kind of swift transportation where you could easily obtain foods from an entirely different terrain, kombucha became a way of ensuring you had something to eat year-round. And it didn't really matter that it was immediately available or not. It could be preserved for a fair amount of time.
Right. And you mentioned the Manyoshu. That's one of those, you know, titles that you always remember when you read a textbook as, one of those Japanese students. But I heard the first example of kombucha as dried rice, I mean, cooked and then dehydrated so that you can just carry around and on your journey to somewhere near or far. And that's why, you know, all the war fields, the soldiers used to carry dried.
Hoshi-i, I think was the name that was given to it. And indeed, it also becomes more lightweight, because as something becomes dehydrated, the water in it, the moisture in it, is what makes it heavy. So it became lightweight, less likely to spoil, and could be revived or resuscitated, softened, and consumed when you needed it, wherever you were. So it's truly, in some sense, a almost a prehistoric convenience food.
Yeah, it might be useful for airplane traveling. So,
well, I don't know. I think it might be worth revisiting that for kinaishoku, for the food that's served on airplanes. There's something to be said for properly softened kombucha being brought back to actually not their original stage, but this more intense, flavorful item. I often, when I'm talking about kombucha, will have people think about the difference between a fresh tomato and a dried tomato, or a fresh apricot and a dried apricot. They might both be wonderful, but they're probably not used in the same way. And the dried item, whether it's a tomato or an apricot or whatever, is going to be very intensely flavored, much more so than the fresh item was originally.
Right. Yeah, so another example I heard during the Edo period, there's, you know, Japan didn't trade with anybody. In theory, but there is a Nagasaki, that's the only port. And there was a big port to export dried abalone and shark fin and all those expensive items. So it's not just, you know, some daily item dried and shrunk. there are some fancy items as well. So kombucha can be diverse.
Yes, thank you for reminding me and everybody else. Indeed, and for ceremonial purposes as well, very often dried goods were placed to show respect for them. They were extremely important in kitchens before modern times because they could be kept for a long period of time and because they could be brought back to life, if you will, whenever you needed them.
Mm. Right. And also, I think kombucha reflect Japanese mindset to preserve everything because such yes. a small country and it's been very poor up until, you know, recent centuries. So, yeah, it's just the mindset of you dry or ferment something available has to be kept. So kombucha is as important right. as fermented items.
Indeed, I remember the first time I saw a kiriboshi daikon, which is the shavings of dried daikon radish that were being made, and very much impressed upon me that nothing went to waste. When daikon were harvested and they were perhaps bruised, you would peel them because you wanted the inner part of the daikon to cook. The peels never went to waste. They could always be dried and used in a number of other dishes. So I think probably kiriboshi was my first personal encounter with a kombucha that would do double duty, if you will, or multitask. It could produce a flavorful broth when it was being softened, and it could also be cooked as a vegetable, either on its own or mixed with a number of other items.
Mm, right, that's another beauty of it. So multitasking is possible. So we'll discuss the details, but I know you are very passionate about kombucha, and why do you think it's valuable? Kombucha is valuable because it's so handy. It's always available in your pantry. Or why do you think it's so valuable?
Personally, today for me, it's my go-to when I don't get a chance to go shopping. I always know that I've got something that I can put together for a meal. All I have to do is open the drawer that I have dedicated to most of my kombucha. What you need, by the way, is a cool, dry, and dark space, and it could be almost anywhere. And for me, it's not necessarily in the kitchen. My backup kombucha is actually, my kitchen is fairly small, is in another location, but it's also cool and dark and dry. And that way I know I can have it whenever I need it.
Mm, maybe you can smell a nice shiitake mushroom smell when you sleep or something like that.
Indeed.
So Elizabeth, you say in a previous conversation is that kombucha is losing popularity in Japan despite its valuable nature. So why do you think kombucha is not used as much as before by the Japanese people?
I think there are possibly two reasons. One is because there's really no advertising and nobody has started an Instagram account to tout how cute and wonderful these little dried darlings can be. And there's a lot of competition for other convenience foods that are available in the supermarket. I think most large supermarkets in Japan will have sort of the basics. They will have this kiriboshi daikon, the dried daikon radish. They'll have hijiki, which is a sea vegetable. They'll have wakame, which is another sea vegetable. But perhaps they won't have many other varieties. And also cooking shows today in Japan are not focusing on it. There's nobody that's really out there trying to popularize them. And younger people, unless they have an example of a mother or a grandmother, perhaps, who has been using them before, may not be familiar with how to use them properly. So there's sort of all sorts of combined reasons, I think, why they've become less popular. Certainly when I first came to Japan in the 1960s, every neighborhood also had specialty stores for kombucha. Those stores had everything from dried beans to dried vegetables and also dried sea creatures that were there. Probably in the last 10 years or so, most of those stores have disappeared, certainly as independent stores. There are a few purveyors, Tomizawa is one of them, that have a lot of kombucha for sale, but they, again, they don't come with explanations and nobody seems to be out there trying to make them more popular.
Right. Yeah, somebody has to make the packaging or some other things sexier for kombucha.
I think so, yeah.
Right, because the value is definitely there. And I mean, if you just throw in one piece of kombucha for your dashi, you are a hero of the evening. I'm not kind of not exaggerating because that happened to me. So, yeah. By the way, you mentioned Tomizawa. I'm not associated with them, but there is it's a big, I think, online grocery website.
They are, and most of the department store food halls in Japan, they'll have a small section for their things. It's sort of an independent shop within the larger one. And certainly when I'm looking for something less ordinary, that would be where I would first look. There are also a few independent sort of artisanal producers of kombucha, but they're very local and very specific to certain products. There are a number of specialty stores for katsuobushi, for kombu, for dried beans, for dried grains. But there aren't the kinds of stores that there used to be when I first came to Japan, which were well-stocked, multi-purpose kombucha, the stores that specialized in kombucha.
Right. And then we tend to, now, the tone of our conversations is like, kombucha is dying, you know, it's very sad. But actually, among chefs, their power never declined. And all top chefs are like, really fighting for the top quality kombu, shiitake, all those things. So
it's
a wholesale level. The value is there, but the consumer level is kind of
That's a good distinction. I'm glad you made it. That's true. I think for the ordinary consumer and the home cook, it might be a little extra effort to be able to source top quality things. But I hope people will give it a go and maybe they'll be intrigued when they're finished listening to this podcast and want to give it a go and try a couple of dishes made with kombucha.
Right. Okay. So we'll take a quick break here, and when you come back, we'll discuss how you can actually use different kinds of delicious kombucha. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. The knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japanese on Heritage Radio Network, HRN. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Elizabeth Ando, a food writer and cookbook author and Japanese cooking instructor based in Tokyo. So let's talk about actual kombucha items and how we can use them. So there are mainly two types of kombucha. One is to make stock and other one is to be cooked into dishes. And also you mentioned they can be both. Right. So could you tell us about them?
Well, the ones that are primarily for stock, the first thing that comes to mind is kombu, kelp. And they're all different varieties. And we did talked about it quite a bit in a previous episode. And depending upon the kind of water that you have access to, the kind of kombu you use is going to be preferred. Here in the Tokyo area where I am, something called Hidaka kombu is the preferred. And down in Osaka, where I used to live, had split my time between Tokyo and Osaka, Ma kombu is the preferred. If you go to an elegant restaurant, it's likely that the broth that you sipped and said, wow, what's this, was made with Ibishiri kombu. And if you went to a temple vegetarian meal, it's likely that it was Daosu kombu. Each of them have distinctive sort of flavor profiles and behave a little bit differently. But basically all kombu needs to be slowly extracted and not actually brought to a boil, just before the boil. One way of recognizing that when you're cooking with it is when you begin to see bubbles starting to break on the surface around the edge, the rim of your pot. And then that's probably the right temperature. In Celsius, it's about 70, 75. And that's when all of the beauty in the kombu and the kelp is allowed to come out into the liquid and you get this lovely broth. There are other kombucha that also go into making stock, things primarily dried fishes. Katsuobushi is probably the most commonly used and the flakes already made, the fushi. And they provide a smoky, wonderful, I call it the bacon of the sea, sort of a smoky element to any stock that's made with it. For those who are vegetarian or vegan and don't wish to use any fish products, shiitake mushrooms can create a gorgeous stock, deeply foresty, woodsy, and enhances the flavor of so many other foods that are cooked with it. One of the other fishes is niboshi, it's used primarily down in the Kansai area, and certainly in Shikoku, where my husband was from and where I had my first Japan experiences. It becomes also known as iriko. It became a very important contributor to many stocks that we used. But purely vegetable stocks too, kiriboshi daikon gives off a lovely, rather sweet stock. So if you're using it to simmer other things, you can cut back on your sugar or eliminate sugar entirely to balance soy sauce that might be used in simmering with it, because the stock itself is so sweet on its own. Kampyo, which is gourd, one of my favorites because it's so versatile. It can be anything made into an addictively good dried chip to nibble on, to making an elegant tie to hold other things together. And it's also that sort of innocuous brown strip in narrow sushi rolls called kampyo maki or nori maki. Kampyo also produces a lovely broth. You need to make sure that the kampyo was dried naturally and not with chemicals. And you can look at the back of the label to check that one out. But it also gives a fairly sweet, not quite as sweet as the daikon one, but a very sweet flavor. And if you're looking to cut back on sugar and meat, it's a choice that you should probably think about.
Okay, so we're going to get into that each item, like as many as that we can, because there's so much to cover. Right. So a couple things before we do that. So we had a conversation, listeners, on episode 131, Elizabeth extensively talked about kombucha that was used in making Japanese traditional dashi stock. So if you're interested, just go to episode 131. And also, Elizabeth's sweet first experience in Japan, let's summarize in episode 18, how she visited Japan and met her husband at the host family. That was a very romantic story. So that's another thing that would be really fun to listen to. And you mentioned kombu. Kombu, of course, is the major source of dashi stock flavors, but they come the vast majority, like 90% comes from Hokkaido. And right. Then interesting that you mentioned different types of different flavors. It's almost like, you know, like a wine from Bordeaux, from Burgundy to vineyards, depending on which part of Hokkaido. So once you get into that, it's also like, oh, you can do this comparison of Hidaka kombu to Rose kombu. And also texture is different. And that determines how you cook it. So it's a whole rabbit hole waiting for you, kombu lovers.
Yes.
Right. And finally, so you mentioned a dried niboshi. Niboshi is a tiny kind of anchovies. And whenever I travel on airplane, I don't want to eat much of airplane food. So I just put it in my bag. And when I get hungry, instead of keep eating a lot of nuts and chocolate, I have some niboshi. And it really keeps your hunger in control. And you feel good because it's full of calcium, protein, and you feel actually healthier. So that's my trouble
tip. And it's a nice chewy texture.
Yes, exactly. Crunchy, chewy. It's like a potato chips too.
Right.
All right. So let's see. So there are various types of kombucha, and of course, it's dried, meaning you have to rehydrate it. So, could you tell us about those different ways to rehydrate?
Right. Depending upon what the item is, the amount of soaking in water is going to change, both the timing of it and the quantity of the water. There are a few items where you should not be consuming that water later. So since you're going to be throwing it away, especially wakame and hijiki, you only need to soak it enough to be able to soften it, get rid of that initial softening water, rinse it very briefly, and then be able to use it.
So you can basically pick up out of the bag, you have a piece of kombucha, and you have clean water, like running, the tap water,
right?
And soak it depending on what kombucha you're talking about.
Right. I like to use glass jars, glass because it's non-reactive, so it's not going to be, if you use a metal or plastic container to soak them, it's possible that there might be some interaction of the flavor. But glass is totally, and also you can see what's happening. So save glass jam jars or whatever, and you put the kombucha in, cover it with water, and most will be softened within 5 to 10 minutes. A few dried shiitake is one of them, depending upon what type of shiitake that you're talking about, need to be soaked longer, possibly 20, 25, almost 30 minutes. The donko, the very thick shiitake that have sort of that mottled appearance on top, they take a long time to soften.
But maximum 30 minutes, and you don't have to do anything. So
nothing. You just have to remember. You just have to remember to do it. And there, the only ones that I wouldn't leave soaking forever are wakame and hijiki. I would let them soak each for maybe minimum of 2 or 3 minutes, maximum 5 or 6. Drain them, rinse them, drain them again. Otherwise, you could do it the night before, the morning before you leave the house. If it's a very warm day, you could put it in the refrigerator and you come back and it's done. I often will put a piece of kombu in a glass jar, fill it with water as soon as I wake up in the morning. And then I've got the beginnings of stock, no matter how I want to finish it off, waiting for me. I don't have to remember to do it later.
Right. And I cannot stress enough how concentrated umami is in all those dried kombucha. So you mentioned apricot, right, or maybe like figs and dried fruits, a very concentrated sugar. But instead, kombucha has tons of umami. And yes, I think it's almost like 100 times or like ridiculous number of, I saw data, raw shiitake to dried shiitake is like 400 times or something, like really concentrated.
Yeah, at least. We probably looked at the same chart at one time. I vaguely remember the number 410 or something like that, but very intensely flavored. The dehydration of the shiitake really concentrates all of the flavor and all of the nutrients as well. So all of the positive nutrients that were in there are going to be more concentrated as well.
Right. So not just the flavor, it's healthy as well. Right. So let's just dive into actual items, because I think majority of our listeners are still like, what? So what kind of kombucha can be used in their own kitchen? So I would like to start with kanso wakame, so dried wakame. And this is the star of my summer salad. So what is kanso wakame, or dried wakame?
Wakame is a sea vegetable. It's not a weed. When it is harvested, it is briefly dipped in boiling water, and that's where the bright green color comes from. If you see wakame as it comes out of the ocean, it's brown, reddish brown, but it turns bright green, and then it is dried naturally. Once it has been packaged, it could be either in long strands or it could already be little pieces. It expands to approximately 3 times the size that it looks like when it comes out of the package. So when you're putting it in your glass jar and you see a couple of sort of shriveled little pieces at the bottom and you're wondering, is that really going to be enough? The answer is probably yes. A tablespoon of dried wakame will give you slightly more than a half a cup, or a half to two-thirds of a cup of wakame once it's softened. I don't know about you, but I tend to cluster my recipes into soups and salads for wakame. I find that it doesn't need a whole lot of cooking. Once it's been softened, it can be dressed in a number of different salad dressings. It can be mixed with lettuce. It can be mixed with other vegetables. In the summer, I love to do a karashi sumiso, which is a mustard, vinegar, and miso sauce that I think is just fabulous, and especially refreshing in hot, sticky weather. When it gets a bit cooler, and I'm looking forward to those days, hasn't gotten cooler yet in Tokyo, I might use another kind of miso with it, a darker red miso, perhaps sweetened with a little bit of mirin or sugar, as a dip, and eat it just as is. In soups, I will often put it at the bottom of a bowl and pour soup on top of it so that it doesn't get sort of overcooked. I like the texture of wakame after it's been softened, and I personally do not like the softer texture that you get from cooking it further.
Right. So yeah, I think the texture is a good point, because when you see it, it's very pretty thin. It's not like kombu that's thick. And somehow I found this convenient package at the grocery store, Japanese grocery store. And it was a beautiful, like a mixture of different colored and a very inexpensive makame. So I bought it and then I was like, great. And then I put some in the bowl and it grew 10 times. It was weeping 10 times, overflowing. But happily, you know, you can use vinegar and, you know, like quick salad, soy sauce and vinegar. It's so refreshing in the summertime.
Right.
And you feel just so good. And also I think it's a great idea to put in a miso soup because the umami multiplies with the miso and wakame.
Right. So, and also with noodle dishes, especially soup noodles. It certainly can be used with ramen, but also with udon. I love the combination of wakame and umeboshi with udon and also with somen, the thinner white noodles.
Right. Yeah, so it's a, like, again, kombucha is another kind of tip or like secret weapon you can add deep in the flavor just by throwing it in because it's so easy to rehydrate.
Yes.
And the wakame is just one of the most handiest kombucha.
Right.
So next one, we have hijiki.
Right.
So that's hijiki is, I'm sure listeners who have been to Japanese izakaya, and hijiki with, you know, the fried tofu and the mixture of the sweet and soy sauce, that's like the classic izakaya item. So what is hijiki and how do you use it?
Okay, so hijiki is also a sea vegetable. It's not a weed. It's a vegetable. When it gets harvested, there are long, I guess you call them fronds. They look almost like a branch on a tree. And you'll often see a hijiki packaged as either mei hijiki, which are the little teeny tiny bud pieces, or naga hijiki, which are the longer pieces. So if you think of a branch that has smaller branches coming off of it, as it gets dried and processed, it usually gets put through a sieve that separates out the longer strands from the smaller bits and pieces. And they can be cooked and used exactly the same way, but I don't know about other people, but I tend to use mei hijiki if the final way I'm going to be serving it is small, like if it's going to be used in an obento, if it's going to be in a tiny little dish. That way I don't have to cut it. I can use it just as is. And I prefer to use naga hijiki when I'm looking to present volume in a larger bowl. And depending upon which size of the hijiki is, it's the exact same plant. It's just a different part of the plant. I might cut the length of the carrots or the fried tofu differently to match it. Again, with naga hijiki, I'll then do sort of julienne carrots that are longer strips, and maybe a green vegetable, also green beans, and cut them on the diagonal and make it a more colorful arrangement. I always make a lot of hijiki. I love the stuff, but I make a lot of it because it will keep for 2 to 3 days after it's been made. And the second use, if you will, is mixed in a tofu sauce, shira-ai. That's also a wonderful dish. And almost inevitably, I will be using, after I make hijiki as a nimono, as a sumed dish, I will 1 or 2 days later be serving it in a tofu sauce.
So next one, what is kampyo?
Okay. Kampyo is a gourd. It's rarely eaten as a gourd. Rather, it gets shaved into ribbons. And those ribbons get cooked into a number of different dishes. The size of the ribbon, the width of it, can change from package to package. And if when you look at the package, it looks very white as opposed to slightly brown, it's probably been bleached. check on the back of the package. And if it's been bleached, that means you should not be using the liquid from softening it. You can still eat the kampia without any problem at all, but I would not recommend trying to use that softening liquid as a broth. Only if for those bleached. That have not right, only for those that have not been chemically dried or bleached.
Right. Yes. So kampio, probably most likely listeners never heard of it, but if you go to sushi, traditional Japanese sushi restaurant, it's most likely you can find kampio raw. And like when I was little, I was too young to eat spicy wasabi sushi. I would right. look for kampio rolls because it's a sweet and crunchy and it's like a great mouthfeel and it has lots of umami. I think that Japanese can get educated about umami on your tongue through those dried items, I think. I think that way.
I think so too. It's an early experience and I think it's a memorable one. And it forms a sort of a background for future flavors that you're going to be tasting. And I certainly think it contributes to an appreciation of umami. Being introduced to it at a very young age. Kampio, the kind that's done in the sushi rolls, has usually been, after it's been softened, it's been simmered in a slightly sweet soy broth. And that's where it gets that brown color from and the sweet flavor. And again, it has a, it's soft, but it's got a nice chew to it. It's very satisfying mouthfeel.
Right. So I heard it's more popular in the Kanto region, which is surrounded in Tokyo region. And if you go to Osaka region, it's not as popular because I think sushi was born in Kanto, in Tokyo. So there's some regional differences. But okay, so the next one is kiriboshi daikon. You mentioned earlier that's right. your favorite. So what is special about it?
Well, it was certainly the first experience that I had with it. So daikon is a radish, and it does get dried out and naturally, but it can also be dried on purpose. And most often it's shreds that you will see in packages that are for commercial sale. People who make it themselves will use scraps from after peeling daikon to use it for other things. For several years, I made a lot of kombutsu myself, but that was actually, I used an electric machine to help me dry things out because Japan is so humid. And I finally decided I couldn't justify all the electricity that was being used for that. When I'm able to dry it naturally, I will. But urban Tokyo life, it's hard. I end up buying most of my kiriboshi daikon. It's a sort of the classic for me is again with carrots and probably fried tofu. Sometimes I will soften it with a piece of kombu at the same time. And then I will take that kombu and actually with scissors, because kombu can get to be slippery and harder to cut with a knife, although you could do it with the tip of a very sharp knife. I will cut it into thread thin pieces and cook them together with the kiriboshi daikon to make an imono. As a matter of fact, I had that for dinner tonight.
Nice. So by the way, daikon, Japanese daikon is big and thick and long. And or Japanese people call young girls big fat legs, the daikon legs.
Yes, that's the same. I know, especially since colored tights were very popular in the 1960s, and I had been called daikon ashi on many occasions.
Yes. That's funny. But there's another thing, like usually American vegetables like eggplants right. are bigger than Japanese native eggplants. But right. in the case of daikon, that's the opposite. It's huge and right. juicy, and it's not like, you know, something you process and it kind of dries out. It's very juicy. That's why, you know, you have to dry, spend a lot of work and time and probably energy to dry. But it's really tasty and concentrated flavor. And because it's daikon, it goes so well with other flavors, like you mentioned, carrots, sweetness, and dried tofu that has rich fat.
Right. The other way I cook it is with bacon and or chicken. And shred it and cook it together. And it's also almost like a main course dish. The vegetable versions will keep longer and be able to be kept in the refrigerator well for 4, 5, 6 days. Once you introduce meat to it, it tends to be, but I'm not unhappy eating it within 2 days. But it will not keep as long. Right.
Okay. So the next one is fun. It's kanten. So kanten is similar to agar-agar and gelatin. And I find it very useful. So what is kanten and what is the difference between agar-agar?
Kanten, again, is a sea vegetable. Tengusa, heavenly grass, is the source of it. And there are different stories, if you will, legends about how it was originally discovered or realized and put to use. Because it's freeze-dried, and I know that sounds very, very modern, but it was a natural freeze-dry. In other words, it was freezing temperatures at night and very dry temperatures during the day. And Nagano Prefecture, which is cold, dry weather, similar to many places in Northern America, was where kanten first really became utilized in large measure. And they, when you dry the tengusa, it turns out to look almost like styrofoam sticks. It sort of doesn't look like it's a food. It is still sold in stick form, although more likely today it's going to be powdered, and the powdered form is easier to use. But the sticks can be either fairly thick blocks, or they could be more narrow threads. It also has nearly zero calories. And is often added, there's kanten that can be eaten just as is. It's a little crunchy, it's a little chewy, and shredded and mixed in salads, and it's sort of a filler. There's another version that can be cooked with rice that will reduce the caloric intake of the same bowl of rice because part of it is kanten as well. But most often kanten is cooked on purpose to make a kind of an aspic or a gelatin.
Right. And I also wanted to see the difference between gelatin. And here is the thing. So kanten, it can be superior to gelatin because of no taste or odor instead of gelatin's animal source.
Right.
And it sits more firmly than gelatin and also sits at room temperature.
Yes.
And it can stay firm at the warmer temperature. So that's why you can find beautiful Japanese-style jelly sweets, like at the tea ceremony or Japanese beautiful wagashi shops served at room temperatures. So.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the specifics of the chemistry and the chemical differences, but also certain things will gel with kanten, like fresh pineapple, that gelatin will never gel. But the one fruit that I had difficulty with, and I have memories of doing a demonstration and the kanten never gelled, was with key limes down in Florida. So I'm not quite sure why key limes. I've done it with sudachi and other kinds of limes and never a problem, but waited and waited and was duly embarrassed to discover that indeed the kanten did not set at all during the demonstration. But otherwise, it's wonderful because it does gel at room temperature, which means you can put it in an obento. And it's also not going to weep the way gelatin often does. And of course, it's vegan. It's not an animal product.
Right. And also, content is not as translucent as agar-agar, but it solidifies very firmly. So there's a trade-off. Right. And also, texture between content and agar-agar, there's a difference. And agar-agar has a melting, soft texture, whereas content has firmer mouthfeel. It's kind of like, I think it's just a higher fiber content, which is good for your digestion too. So, you can play with these three players, content, agar-agar, and gelatin, but content is pretty advantageous in many occasions when it comes to texture and temperature.
Right. It's great to have in the kitchen. And again, the powdered form is easier. So the sticks, when you want to use them to cook into an aspic, for example, you have to soak them, you have to squeeze them, you have to simmer them. It's a fairly multi-stage process to be able to cook with it. The powdered form merely needs to be soaked in a small amount of water, just enough to sort of moisten it, and then cooked and stirred into whatever flavored liquid you're going to be using for your aspic. So it's much easier to use. And it can often be used with other foods to help them become slightly firmer. I don't do a whole lot of baking or confectionery making, but it's a very important ingredient for many confections.
What kind of examples do you have?
Well, as you pointed out, for the tea ceremony sweets, there are many that are primarily content, but there's also a snack that I happen to personally love. It's made with dried persimmons and kantan, they're wonderful little chewy snacks, and you're cooking them all together. It forms sort of a loaf, and they can be cut into smaller pieces and enjoyed almost like caramels, the flavor is persimmon, and it's quite wonderful. So it's used in a lot of confections, candies, here in Japan, and I suspect could be a sort of a secret ingredient for similar textured foods that are served outside Japan as well. A lot of people have discovered kantan, if you will, as an option for cooking, but I like to keep it on hand, especially in the summer, to be able to make cool sort of slithery when you're eating them down your throat dishes. The other is it makes a wonderful coffee jelly.
Yes.
That you can form in a coffee cup, and then you can, if you want to pipe some whipped cream on top, you can do that as well. But cookie ziti in Japan is a popular way to use kantan.
Right. I didn't know that it was so available everywhere in Japan. I didn't know that it was pretty unique in Japan until recently, actually. And so listeners, if you go to Japanese convenience stores or supermarkets, they definitely always have coffee jelly. Right. And their coffee tend to be intense, and it's the flavor is just so unique. And the cream on top, that's addictive, sweet. And I have to admit, I'm addicted to it. So... All right. And so we've discussed several kombuzu items today, and many of which happen to be made with sea vegetables, seaweed, but they are not the only ones. Of course, a lot of different kombuzu, and of course, for kombu, dashi, and katsuobushi, bonito, they're all umami rich, and it's unlimited. So yeah, I think hopefully our listeners can discover some of those and try easily at their own kitchen today. So, and you have lots of valuable resources about kombucha and everything else on your website and your books. So tell us how our listeners can find them.
The easiest way to find a catalog of suggestions is a post that I put up a couple of days ago to my Kitchen Culture blog. So tasteofculture.com is my website. And if you go to the Kitchen Culture tab, the current one that's being displayed is indeed on Kambutsu. And once that gets archived, you can always do a search on my website for it. It's interesting. Do you spell it with an M or an N? And I tend to spell it with an M. I also use M for kombu rather than konbu. The actual hiragana could go either way. And depending upon whose book you're reading and who you're talking to, it could be an N or an M for the spelling. I think my website is trained to recognize both, but I do spell it with an M, K-A-M-B-U-T-S-U. And I call them the dried darlings of the Japanese pantry. So it's likely if you do a search under any of those words, you're going to be able to come up with it. But what I did was a list of recipes and whole chapters in my book that are devoted to kombutsu, as well as links to specific ones that are already archived on my website.
Right, I'm looking at the page kombutsu you posted on September 25th, and it's just beautiful pictures. If your listeners had not a visible idea of what we are talking about today, it's beautiful, beautiful pictures and recipes, and I really realized kombus are very healthy too. So
yes,
yeah,
all of the nutrients that would be in the fresh item are more concentrated. So all of the, many of them have a great deal of calcium, certainly a lot of fiber, and other trace minerals as well. All of that has been sort of concentrated and locked into the kombutsu. So they're not being lost when you're cooking them later.
Right. Okay, so where can we find your updates online and on social media? In addition to your website.
Okay, so on my website also is a way to easily click into the Facebook group that I run, which is the Kitchen Culture Cooking Club, and I also have a tab for that on my website. And once a month, I try to keep to that schedule. Once a month, I will post a new project that's related to whatever topic I've chosen for the Kitchen Culture blog. I haven't posted one specifically for kombutsu, but the last newsletter that I did was about kompyo, and you can also find that on my website and a whole page devoted to kompyo and recipes about it, and also the history of it, all sorts of information about that. So probably I'd suggest that people start at my website and all of the other links, including once this recording is available, I'll list it under my podcasts and they can listen to it again there. So that's a good place, I think, to start. Also, my Twitter account, I try to post to both. I'm not quite as active as I probably should be. Sorry about that.
Like everybody else.
Right.
So, right. But again, the website is tasteofculture.com.
Right.
One word. Right. So at the bottom, there's links to Facebook and Twitter. So,
right.
Yeah. So thank you so much. And I really enjoyed another 10th episode with you.
Thank you.
And looking forward to the next one. So we have to discuss what to discuss next time.
Right.
Right. All right, so thank you so much, Anne.
Thank you.
So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@theheritagerealnetwork.org or akikotema.com. Japan Needs is a weekly program and always available at heritagerealnetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Amin Spenjan, and thank you for listening. I will see you next week. Japan Eats is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.